Today's episode of the Hash Rate Podcast is brought to you by Luxor Technology, North America's largest mining pool. Luxor's goal is to operate enterprise-class mining pools with professionalism and an intense customer focus. They provide a top-notch user experience and have a great selection of pools for you to mine to, from a variety of notable altcoins to Big Daddy Bitcoin, for which they launched their mining pool in October, so be sure to go and check them out. We are incredibly grateful that Luxor has chosen to sponsor this show going into 2020. We would love it if you, as listeners, would support the show by supporting them. You can find them online at luxor.tech and give them a follow on Twitter at Luxor Tech Team. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into the Hash Rate Podcast, the best crypto mining podcast in the history of the world. Today's conversation, we have Mauricio de Bartolomeo, co-founder of Ledin, joining us to discuss the current political situation in Venezuela. We also talk about Bitcoin as a solution down there, and then we get into proof of reserves. Now, I will let you know, the first 25 minutes or so of this show, we are really focused on the political climate in Venezuela. We do get into Bitcoin and cryptocurrency related content after that, but just be aware, if you'd like to get right to the nitty-gritty details of cryptocurrency and Bitcoin as we discuss it on the show, you'll want to skip ahead to about minute 25. I found this entire conversation incredibly enlightening. We're so sheltered from what's actually going on in the world. Mainstream media does a terrible job nowadays of providing good, honest content, and it's hard to determine what is what when it comes to the geopolitical sphere and all that is going on. So having Mauricio on the show was eye-opening, and I hope you all enjoy this conversation. If you would, please leave us a rating and review on your preferred listening platform. We really appreciate your continued support. And as always, today's episode of the Hashrate Podcast is presented to you by Hashrate OS. Hashrate OS is a Linux-based operating system designed to help you increase the efficiency of your mining machines and maximize your overall profitability. Now with ASIC and GPU support, Hashrate OS provides the best experience in crypto mining, allowing you to manage your facility fully from any mobile device and take complete control of your mining operations. Hashrate OS is mining as it should be. Be sure to head over and check out the Hashrate operating system at os.hashrate.com. Again, that's os.hashr8.com. All right, without further ado, on to the show. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the Hashrate Podcast. It is me, the Bitcoin Broski, here today with our special guest, Mauricio de Bartolomeo, the CEO of Ledin. And Mauricio, I'm thankful that you're able to come on the show today. I know we've got a lot to talk about. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well. Enjoying this rally and happy to be here.
This rally, Bitcoin's pumping. It's a way to go into a weekend.
It is. It's the best way to go into the weekend.
I don't normally do this, but in this case, I'd love for you to just let everyone know a little bit about yourself and also about Ledin.
Definitely. Yeah. So my name is Mauricio. For those who haven't heard about us, I'm originally from Venezuela, born and raised. Although I came to Canada to do my university, my whole family was still back there. So 2015 there is where I got introduced to Bitcoin. From that point on, I became enamored at how I was helping people in Venezuela navigate the currency controls and hyperinflation. So I became obsessed with building products that help people save in Bitcoin and hold their Bitcoin for longer. As a Venezuelan miner, I was, you know, it was very painful to have to sell your Bitcoins to grow the business. So the idea of setting up a lending service was there really from my early beginnings of my experiences with Bitcoin. So coming to Canada and getting together with Adam, my business partner, we started setting up mines here. We kept running into the same issue. And basically what we saw as the biggest problem in Bitcoin at the time, this was 2 years ago, was the fact that to us, it was the world's greatest asset, but to financial institutions worldwide, it was not even considered an asset. Nobody would let you pledge it as collateral for a loan. And so we realized how badly the space needed this and how great it would be if we could build a truly transparent and compliant Canadian company to provide this service worldwide. And that's what we set out to do. And today, long story short, Ledin is serving thousands of users really in over 70 countries, a lot of them in Venezuela and Colombia. And so I get to talk to a lot of fellow Venezuelans on almost a daily basis. So I'm very excited. And yeah, that's just a little bit about myself and Ledin.
Awesome. Yeah. And for the listeners out there, Mauricio agreed to come on the show to talk about some of the things that are going on in Venezuela. We get mixed information, obviously being in North America, it's really hard to trust news anymore. I don't know that anyone, especially in crypto, trusts anything that mainstream media says. So I'm glad that we're able to talk about this. Also, we're going to discuss proof of reserves, which, you know, Mauricio will explain a little bit more about, and talk about the transparency movement in 2020. This is something that Hashrate is a huge proponent for. Ledin, Mauricio, his team as well. Just the understanding that the way the business has been done up to this point is not going to be what carries us towards mass adoption. There needs to be more personal responsibility, a higher level of ethics, and ultimately transparency for companies, the end users, et cetera. So I guess we should start right at the top, man. I think the last time we talked, you were actually in Venezuela. Did you go down there recently for like the holidays or something?
No, I wanted to, and I was planning to, but the issue, Venezuela has this very tricky law where if you're a dual citizen, if you have hold or ever held a Venezuelan citizenship, you must exit the country with a current Venezuelan passport. And that becomes a challenge because they are not renewing it.
Okay.
And so the people whose passports expire, which was the case of myself and my wife, cannot really enter the country without running the risk of not being able to leave. And, you know, with my 2-year-old daughter, that was just too much of a risk to run this year. And, you know, our passports are still in the process. Mine, thankfully, has been printed as per the last status, but I'm still waiting on my wife's. So I do plan to go this year at some point. I'm just kind of waiting on some moving pieces that are outside of my control, unfortunately.
So from my understanding, I mean, the inflation is insane at the moment. The political climate is tumultuous. And I'd like you to walk us through what's been occurring over the last couple of years.
A year ago today, actually, we were entering, walking through Venezuela's most noticeable moment in recent history, because this Guaido, which was the president of the National Assembly, had essentially said that he was the president of the National Assembly and that because of the Maduro presidential elections have been fraudulent, then the National Assembly was the, you know, by the de facto new ruler of the country as at the end of Maduro's term. That happened on January 6th of last year. And essentially it caught the regime somewhat blindsided. And it seemed like countries around the world were kind of ahead of time getting ready to support this move from Guaido. And so it looked as if the international community was rallying behind Guaido and that enough pressure was actually going to mount for Maduro to renounce and allow for democratic elections in the country. What people didn't anticipate was the fact that Maduro and his gang were criminals and they had absolutely no interest in talking with politicians. And so despite the fact that the entire world said, hey, you need to let food enter the country, you need to allow for democratic elections, we are going to bring the food forcefully. And they, you know, they did this big concert and brought the trucks down to the border. Maduro, on the other hand, basically said, if you cross through, we're going to shoot you down. And he brought military and blocked the bridges. So essentially, it became very clear, like the world kind of came together and said, we want to take you out peacefully, and said, we are going to put all the peaceful pressure that we can so that you understand that you need to change and leave. What he said was, and part of my French, but he said, I don't give a crap, I don't give a fuck. And he said, I will shoot you if you come in, and I dare you to come and make me leave.
From the pictures that I've seen, the grocery stores are basically barren. So how are people getting food and medicine and things of that nature now? Or is it just not available?
So let's go through that, because that's an important question. So the government of Venezuela employs something like, I don't have the data right now, and who knows what data to believe anymore coming out of Venezuela, but from anecdotal data that's available, the government of Venezuela is the largest employer in the country. It employs about 60% of the entire working population in the country. So essentially, the government has its voter base on payroll. And not only does it have its voter base on payroll, it has them on food boxes that are periodically delivered. And even if the pay that you receive as your payroll is not sufficient, the government, in addition, gifts you food every month. And this is also, you have to caveat that with government work is no work. All these people are constantly on vacation. So what the government has done is essentially it's put its own critical mass to win elections on payroll. They've basically done the numbers and said, okay, we need to have 5 million Venezuelans vote for us every election. We need to keep 5 million Venezuelans employed and fed. And that's what's going to keep us in power, regardless of no matter what we do. Right. So if you do the math, Venezuela is an oil production country, and you can do some numbers and say Venezuela in its heyday was producing 3.5 million barrels per day. Today, that's been decimated down to 700,000 per day. But even at 700,000 per day, let's say 700,000 per day times, let's just call it $50 for Venezuelan heavy oil. That's 7 times 5. So if I got my zeros right, I believe that's $35 million a day. In revenue, right? So if you'd say, okay, I have $35 million a day in revenue and I have to keep 5 million people fed, and basically, you know, say I have to spend $1 a day on them in food and $1 a day of them in salary, right? That's, which is vastly more than it actually costs, but let's just use those numbers. If you had to keep 5 million people employed and fed every day of the year, that would cost you $10 million a day. The Venezuelan oil revenue alone is $35 million a day.
Right.
So they have a mass of people that are literally collecting food stamps and free money every month that enable them to stay in power and essentially brutalize the rest of the people in the country that do not agree with that system.
So they're basically extorting the country's oil reserves or the people of the country. I assume they're keeping that profit for themselves then?
Yeah, so there's a few revenue lines. So what's going on is they've taken the oil revenue, which is the main bloodline of the country, and they've made sure those funds are only going to be destined to keeping those people fed and giving them free money so they continue voting for you. Right?
Right,
that's like the main one. But then there's other people you have to pay, right? So like, how do you pay the military crooks that suppress all the protests every time people get upset, so that you don't get overthrown, right? You have to pay the military too. And so what he does is he takes the drug trafficking trade and the illegal gold mining trade, as well as the illegal fuel trade. Venezuela fuel has the greatest subsidy in the planet. To fill a tank in Venezuela. To give you an idea, you could buy an entire 18-wheeler full of gas in Venezuela for roughly $5. So what's happening is obviously the military that is in charge of the distribution goes, fills it up at the government set rate, crosses the border, sells it at $1 a liter. And that's how the militaries are kept happy. The other piece that the military does is that the drug trafficking trade used to be run by the Colombian cartels, Cartel de Medellin. And what happened when Chavez came into power around the late 90s, was that magically all those cartels left Colombia, which was hugely celebrated in Colombia. But what wasn't celebrated was that they crossed the street and came to Venezuela because Chavez invited them. So when the drug trade starts running out of Venezuela, they start getting support and protection from the Venezuelan army. And as basically they go deeper into this relationship, they realize that why am I sending these drugs through illegal trade routes when I could just be flying them on a Venezuelan army plane, right? And they essentially start delegating more and more functions to the Venezuelan army. Today, the Venezuelan army is the largest a terrorist drug trafficking organization in the world. They've taken over all of the. Part of it is my experience from being there. There's data that El Cartel de los Soles is the name that's been informally placed, and there's been identified kingpins within the cartel too. This is information that's available online.
Sure.
So the Venezuelan drug cartel essentially is how the military gets their cut, right? And keeps Maduro in power. So you're getting, so the military is getting their cut from all of the drug trafficking and illegal transporting of subsidized goods. The people are getting the free cut of the free food and the free, free food and free employment perks.
Yeah.
That they get. And then, what's in it for the people in power, right? Like, how do they make money? Well, they have the rights to print everything they want as far as bolivares go. And now they've created a new thing that they can print that's called the petro.
Good old ERC-20 token.
Yeah, and so essentially you see how there are these three revenue silos that are divvied up between these three, call it main participants in this space. And they are the three participants that have the other participant in the whole equation, the fourth, which is the impresarios, the business people, the people that actually should be powering and driving the country. They're all cornered. They're constantly extorted, harassed, and that's why we leave.
For anyone that doesn't know, Venezuela is resource rich. The last I checked, they have the largest oil reserve in the world. Saudi Arabia is second. They have a tremendous amount of other resources. I mean, natural gas, gold, bauxite, Yeah. So again, just items that should exponentially increase GDP, especially as we're moving in towards a technological age where things like that are more in demand than ever before. Okay. So the situation as it stands now, you've got a government that's corrupt, clearly. Is there an outlook for improvement at all? I mean, is the country too far gone? What's the sentiment?
So a year ago today, there was this big euphoria and expectation that there could be political change. And there was a huge rally that continued into a crescendo until around, I believe it was February 16th, which the whole thing culminated on Richard Branson's concert and the trucks trying to come through, Maduro shooting the trucks down, and then the story just disappeared from the news. As a Venezuelan, I can tell you, I've lived through 21 years of Chavismo now, which is, way too long for any one political party to be in power. But in the 21 years of Chavismo, I've felt like there was the potential to democratically have a change in the country three times in my life. One was during the Paro Petrolero, which was the first, the first protests that was enacted by the country when Chavez took office. That was when there was a big shutdown of the oil company, National Oil Company, which ended up with Chavez firing everybody and repopulating the company with his buddies. That was one time. The second time was the Capriles election. So once Chavez had died, they had to hold a new election, and there was this guy, Maduro. Everybody was just tired and fed up of Chavez, and people just felt like there was this chance that the truth would win and that, you know, they would hold an honest election and that the opposition would win. That mm-hmm. didn't happen. That didn't happen at all. They stole the election, of course. And that was in 2014. And then the last time I actually ever felt there was a chance was a year ago today. Now, what happened since then is Maduro continued being Maduro and said, I'm not going to change my actions until you come and physically remove me from this place. The world said, well, none of us have the sort of money or support to enter into a new country and do physical conflict, so we're just going to sanction you. And Maduro said, fine, I can live all day long with sanctions. And because I can create petros and I can get life rafts from my buddies in China and Russia. And that's in essence what's been happening. The attention of the media is gone. Nobody cares about Venezuela anymore at this point. Venezuelans feel completely abandoned. There's huge disappointment within Venezuela because we essentially realized what we were up against. It's just a bunch of criminals that don't care about their people. And so that created a bit of a new exodus in migration. So there's been a new, call it wave of migration outbound. The other piece that's happened is, so what Maduro did to kind of appease the tensions in the country was that he allowed people to transact in dollars. And now what's happened today is that companies now feel more comfortable importing foreign goods because they can price them in dollars locally. And what that created was, suddenly people that hadn't been importing goods for 4 years were like, okay, well, now I can start bringing back some goods because I can price them in dollars. And so people started, there was a bit of a respur of import activity, which created an illusion of economic well-being in the country, because all of a sudden some shelves were restocked. And Maduro essentially printed a bunch of inorganic money, created the petro to kind of create more confusion around inflation so that he could create more inorganic money and make it last a little bit longer, this whole idea of a temporary bonanza. And so that's really what the petro is. So the petro is essentially a shitcoin that you can print at will. And the only off-ramp from that shitcoin is another shitcoin that you can print at will.
So let's walk through that a little bit more. All right. Because there's a few things that you mentioned that I think we should talk in detail about. So first, definitely the petro. So the petro is an ERC-20 token, which by definition means that the creator of the initial token has the ability to continuously print those. Initially, they were pegged to a barrel of oil, right? Wasn't mm-hmm. that the initial peg? And I believe they had set that to 100 million barrels. That was the initial peg for the petro. Since then, that's gone out the window from what I understand. Now,
right.
They're printing them. They're then transferring those to ETH?
No. So here's what's happening. So full disclosure, I've been really trying to dig into the petro on the technical side of things and confirm that it is an ERC-20 token, seeing if I can find a node or a block explorer for it. It is by no account a blockchain. I could not confirm to you if it's an ERC-20 token based on what I have read so far. There is no node that you can download and run to see the status of the chain.
Okay.
There is no real block explorer available for it. It's more like a transaction explorer, if you want to call it that. And so it's completely obscure. It is literally just called a crypto. It is a database that is literally controlled entirely by them and has absolutely no information for its users. So what happens when you get a petro, right? My mom got a petro, so I've gone through this and I can kind of tell you how it works. What the government has been trying to do with the petro is essentially saying, I've created this new money that is way harder than the Bolivar, and I am giving it to you for free, you, the Venezuelan person. Obviously, that's the message they're trying to deliver. It is obviously absolutely false. You cannot create something valuable and assign a value just because you say it's assigned that value. So here's what happened with the petro. The Venezuelan government said, we're going to create this coin, and we're going to assign the value of this coin at $60 per petro. Great. I'll throw the question back to you. What is the market value of a good?
Whatever someone else is willing to pay for it.
So if there is someone always willing to take the other side of the trade at $70, then the petro is worth $70. Correct. However, if that person that is on the other side of the trade has conditions, restrictions, or is not always available to take the other side of the trade, then that's not the market value of your good. And that's obviously everybody knows that. But what happens is, and what they've done is essentially they've thrown these petros into the wild, and the only person that is really ever wanting to buy them is the Venezuelan government, right? And the only currency with which they can buy that petro is with bolivares, because it's the only currency they have, because they can print it for free.
Right.
Right. So what's happening now is everyone's being given these petros, these free petros, and they go up to the government and say, hey, how do I spend it? Nobody wants to buy this from me. And the government says, no, okay, nobody wants to buy from you. Then I'm going to pass a law that demands all government institutions to only charge things in petros. So now he's saying, okay, well, if it's a government institutions, then I need my petros to pay my notary expenses, to pay my electricity, to pay my this, right? At the end of the day, it's the government buying those petros. When you're paying government services with it, the government still has to become the end buyer of them, right? They still need to give the Bolivar liquidity to whoever else is bringing those petros. So they need desperately to find a private third-party person that is willing to pay hard money for those petros. But no one's doing it. No one's stepping up to the plate.
Why would they?
And nobody will. That's kind of the whole point of this is he's now trying to force, for example, there was a news report that broke yesterday that they're trying to force foreign airlines to refuel in Venezuela and pay with petro. That's just like they're trying to really find outliers that have dollars that can pay for petros and trying to force them to pay for petro. So what's happening is the other thing they don't want to show is they don't want to show that people don't want to pay that amount of money for the petro, right? So in the exchanges that are in Venezuela, even the ones that are licensed, there are no bids on the petro order books, literally no bids, because they're not letting anyone show bids below the price that they fixed, right, that they set. So if someone's wanting to pay $50 for the petro when they say it's worth $70, we're not showing that bid. If somebody wants to show $35 for the petro, we're not showing that bid. we're only going to show bits above 70.
So they've in effect turned a cryptocurrency into a fiat. Fiat currency is something that's only backed by an army. So they've taken the petro and created the first.
100%.
Yeah. Wow.
100%. And so the only way that people are getting these petros because they didn't want any more bolivares. And the only way they can get rid of those petros is getting more bolivares.
You mentioned also China and Russia. Let's talk more about that. Whenever someone's sanctioned, it seems like the first people they call are China and Russia because they don't really give a shit about what the United States says or does, at least not, you know, publicly. What's the relationship there? I assume that a big part of the exports from Venezuela as far as oil go to those two countries.
Yeah, so China was very good at, during the oil boom that Venezuela had, anywhere from 2012 to 2015-17, was just a massive oil boom. And what ended up happening was China identified that Venezuela was becoming a very rich country. They identified that they were ideologically aligned because Chavez was pupil of Fidel Castro, and Fidel Castro has always been a fan of Mao and China. So they saw an opportunity to essentially buy an allegiance or come in and do some really interesting trades with Venezuela. So over the course of 5 years, they ended up trading. A lot of the projects that China did in Venezuela was they traded mirrors for gold. They said, I'm going to build a railroad for you in exchange for your oil production for the next 5 years. Right? So they paper the deal. Venezuela now has this huge liability that they owe X amount of years of future oil production to the Chinese government. And in exchange, they're getting a railroad. Well, what ended up happening was all the funds for the railroad got stolen. No railroads were ever built. And Venezuela still has all of its liabilities to China intact. So they stole all the railroad money in exchange for selling Venezuela's future and not accounting for it. Because it was all done by one group, nobody had any checks and balances on these people. So China has a very vested interest in maintaining Venezuela as a, you know, crippled producer of oil that has to go back to them every time they're desperate. Because when somebody comes to you and they're desperate, usually you can make pretty good deals. So China makes money every time Venezuela gets desperate. Every time there's a sanction, Venezuela goes and China makes a great deal. And it seems to work for everybody because Maduro gets the months he needs. China gets the oil they need. The United States ends up looking good. It's a bit of a mess.
And then Russia.
Yeah. Well, Russia is interesting because, you know, I go back and forth. Like, to me, it's almost like, you know, I feel like all of these guys are already in agreement with things. And what we see publicly is just it's a theater. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of why it's really disappointing when you hear things like, Russia is said to stop helping Maduro because of this and because of that. And then the very next week you read, oh, Russia actually sends, 3,000 new troops to Venezuela. And so I feel like there's this almost like a campaign to keep people confused and to keep people guessing and to never know what their actual intentions are, because they publicly act like everybody is outraged with what's happening. But when their actions essentially tell you that they're all making money and they're all happy.
Politics has always been theater, but I think now it's more PR than anything else. I mean, it used to be that you couldn't put news on that had a spin to it. And if you put news on that was spun either to the right or to the left or played to a certain party, it was shunned. And now that's all there is, right? There's only partisan politics. There's only narrative news. So there's not really a way to decipher what's real and what's not. I agree with you 100% that what's going on behind the scenes and what we're seeing is not the same thing. And I think the clearest example of that from America right now is the quote-unquote conflict with Iran that lasted all of what, a week? No one's talking about it now on the news cycle because it doesn't play into the political sphere. Now everyone's talking about impeachment. News is weird. News is definitely not what it used to be. And in a situation like Venezuela, it's now easy to cast a blind eye. When you talk about the exodus and people migrating out, I know we had talked about this before. I mean, I grew up in South Florida and I grew up in an area, the Venezuelan community is particularly prevalent. And I mean, there's been a huge amount of growth in that community over the last 15 years, but specifically in the last five.
Listen, I think, you know, the older I've gotten and the more I get to sort of see these cycles play out, I think it's fascinating. And maybe, you know, we can touch on this like very somewhat twisted dynamic, because what ends up happening in a country when you elect a socialist government is they end up getting all these, you know, public things and free things and all these goods that are going to perceive to make everyone's lives better. So I think what's happening right now is governments, and particularly the socialist structure of government, is taking advantage of the ignorance or lack of understanding that there is around monetary policy, right? Like, it is very challenging to understand the concept of taxation by inflation. Like, it took me like decades to really understand that. And I consider myself someone that is, you know, an avid reader of economic theory, and I'm in this space that routinely discusses monetary policy. So if you are somebody that has been dedicating a lot of time of their lives to this, and you still have a hard time understanding what taxation by inflation is, how are you supposed to understand that electing a socialist president that is offering you free things is going to make your savings disappear and your job opportunities just go out the window? And it is because people can relate to this idea. It's much easier to relate to an idea and a concept, especially when it comes associated with free things, than it is actually playing out the impact of those decisions on the long run. Is, I think, the missing link, is that people are essentially they don't get the full picture. They don't, because the effect is not immediate, they don't associate it with it. So the people in Venezuela did not associate inflation with Chavez doing a bad job. They associated inflation with prices going up, which Chavez can very easily spin and saying it's because the evil capitalist owners of stores increased their prices. It's not because I'm doing anything wrong, right? And I think until people can fully understand what printing money and giving free things away does to their actual life, not today, but in 5 years, we're going to continue to elect these populist governor or pop, you know, these types of politicians that will come in and selling you the easy way out every single time.
I don't remember which politician said it, but I think it was Thomas Jefferson that said that as soon as a society learns that they can vote the nation's coffers into their own pockets, it's the end of a republic. And it's, again, it's just socialist politics. So, you know, not to dive too deep down the political rabbit hole, I want to get back to the Bitcoin situation in Venezuela. I mean, Bitcoin fixes this is kind of a cliche that gets thrown around a lot. In Venezuela, outside of Venezuela, there's a lot of Venezuelans that have an interest in Bitcoin. What's the Bitcoin and crypto culture aside from the Petro like down there?
It's a great question. I think it's a very important point to touch on. Everybody talks about Venezuela. It's become a bit of a poster child on Bitcoin, you know, forums and the community. The reality is that Venezuelan people are, you know, money, the Venezuelan money, as is known to most Venezuelans, does not work. It inflates at rates that make it impossible to use, and it's certainly impossible to save. And so Venezuelan people have to find other means of saving, because when you have a hyperinflationary currency, that's really the biggest problem, is you can't save, you can't store your value, right? Dollars are the obvious choice, obviously, whenever there is an issue like this. For a really long time in Venezuela, the dollar itself was fully outlawed. So, you know, it was illegal to actually own or buy any dollars. And if you had any and you couldn't prove that you bought them directly from the government, they would take them from you. So nobody could have dollars, nobody wanted them. And Bitcoin kind of had its moment in this type of environment in Venezuela. So Bitcoin came around when Chavez died and the new guy stole the election. That was when the real exodus started. Like, when a lot of people said, okay, these guys literally are crooks. They're not interested in having democracy. I'm just going to pick up my bags and go. So in the context of that happening, Venezuela outlawed the purchase of dollars. So that, you know, people couldn't buy them and take them away, right? And so what people started doing was, you know, effectively that very moment, the black market for a dollar was created, because you cannot tell people what to do and what not to do. People are just going to do it anyway. So people started buying dollars and taking their money out, as they should have. And what happened was, obviously, there wasn't too many dollars going around because not too many people were participating in this. So people were desperately looking for other things to buy that could be effectively sent abroad and store value. And along comes Bitcoin. And when people, the first few people start transacting with Bitcoin, they realize, oh my God, this is really great. I don't have to call Wells Fargo or my Panama bank now to approve this wire. Everything just moves smoothly. And so they said, okay, I want to learn more about this. How do you make more Bitcoin? And they're like, oh, you can mine them. Oh, how do you mine? Well, you need a lot of electricity. Electricity is free in Venezuela. So people are like, I'm going to buy some machines. And so they start buying some machines, and that creates an ecosystem, because now you have people that are producing Bitcoin in Venezuela, and then you have people that are looking to buy Bitcoin to leave it, to have, you know, to exit capital out of the country. So the marketplaces start doing really well. Sir Bitcoin was a very famous exchange. It got shut down 2015, but it worked really well while it was on. Then people moved over to local Bitcoins. And that kind of kickstarted this whole Bitcoin economy, right? The fact that there's a ton of miners, the fact that a lot of people were looking to buying and selling it to transact with it, or a lot of people were just like buying chunks of a Bitcoin here and there and saving up to leave the country. So there was just a market, and people found a use for it. They found it, I say this often, but they found Bitcoin out of necessity, and they returned to Bitcoin out of convenience. So right now, even though the economy is fully dollarized in Venezuela, if you try to pay, so right now you can go to Venezuela and buy bread with a $20 bill, right? Like, it's completely dollarized. That did not exist when I was there. This is all a phenomenon that's happened in the last year. But that being said, if you show up to Venezuela with a $20 bill and that bill has a scratch on it or whatever, a stamp on it or whatever, a person will say, I will not accept this bill. Or they can say, I'll accept it for $15. I'll give you $15 for it, even though it's a 20.
So it has to be completely fresh money.
Yeah. And the other challenge is you can't deposit it anywhere, right? Right. And you can't, you know, send it to Amazon, right? Like, how do you, you know, it's still a challenge because there are not very many local dollar accounts. And the ones that are there are managed by the government's banks. We all know how everyone feels about those.
Right.
So people still have a need or use for Bitcoin, and to a higher degree, more often than not, stable coins. And so,
really, which stable coins? I mean, are we talking Tether, USDC? Is it a combination?
So right now, Tether is a common one. DAI is a common one. Mm-hmm. You know, I think those would be the most common ones. The Pax name comes up here and there. So it's still by no means mainstream, mm-hmm. but we are seeing more and more people talk about stable coins and, you know, demand or want stable coins. So it is something that, I think solves a problem for Venezuela. We are partners with DAI. We have a partnership with MakerDAO that allows our users to borrow funds to get the funds in DAI. So we do process a lot of our DAI loans to the LATAM, countries. So stable coins are becoming a bit of a thing, but what Bitcoin is doing and what these currencies are doing, even the dollar, is just filling a void. Right. The void that was left by a currency that stopped working, and that void has to get refilled. And so some people, you know, some of the use case of that currency for small payments and for day-to-day bread purchases might be dollar bills. You know, the use case for the money that you had on your trading account that you wanted to make some investments on, perhaps that use case cannot be dollars anymore. Perhaps that has to be Bitcoin or stablecoins.
So in that case, I mean, since there is more of a need for it, is there wider adoption? Do you see a higher incidence of stores accepting Bitcoin, local merchants, things of that nature?
You know what's funny? Yes. Yes, for one, but again, by no means is it mainstream. Mm-hmm. But what's happening is that in its desperate effort to get anyone to accept the petro, the government is equipping these companies with these tools to basically get petro payments. But these companies wouldn't be too excited about this if the features would only allow them to just take petros. So whenever they get set up to accept petros, they get set up to accept every other currency, right? Like stable coins, Bitcoins, Litecoin, you know, five or six more. And what ends up happening once they get the payment terminal is they start demanding everything except for the petro. So while they are trying to push this network of payments on some of the larger chains so that they are forced to take the petro, what's happening is because they want to sell this as like a futuristic thing, and it wouldn't really be a good narrative if all you could use at those shops was the petrol. You're like, now you can use the petrol. And because the petrol is modern, like Bitcoin, you can also use. So basically they get a bit of a branding kick by saying, oh, you can pay with Bitcoin, Lightning, or petrol, right? Because now they get to put petrol up in that kind of technology realm. But the unintended effect that that's having is that now you show up to a shop and they're like, yeah, I want to pay with Petros. And they're like, no, we'll take Tether, DAI, Bitcoin, Litecoin, Dash. And if you have nothing else, we'll take Petro at like 70% of what it's value.
You've been into mining. I know others in Venezuela that are mining. To me, it seems like in a system where the government is so corrupt, electricity would be hard to come by. And if you were able to get it, you know, getting in large amounts strikes me as a particularly expensive proposition. Is that not the case?
Yeah. So Venezuelan electricity, well, maybe to give you some more color, every service, every public service that the government provides to its people in Venezuela is virtually free right now. And when I say virtually, I mean the square root of a penny is what you would pay. For example, electricity is free, but with everything free, it's not always available. So there are rolling blackouts often, probably once a day now for 4 to 5 hours. So that's a challenge. The other challenge is internet connection. So none of the ISPs, internet service providers, have maintained any infrastructure. It's all been decimated because they were all taken over by the government. So the internet is basically slow to a crawl. It goes down very often. And the only reliable sources of internet are satellite internet sources, which you end up paying, you know, top dollar for. Mm-hmm. And they're not really the best for Bitcoin. And then the last piece is government extortion. So the second you grow a mining facility to, you know, anything that can be detected, so anything over 10 machines where they can see a spike on electricity draw, or they can see excess heat, or they can hear noise, even though you might have, you know, your machines properly purchased and registered with the right government bodies, et cetera, you will get the odd visits of people demanding money for either protection or not ratting you out, or not, you know, threatening you. It is a very, very hostile environment to be a miner. So I would not recommend it. It is a hostile environment to literally do anything.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And, you know, I definitely want us to get to proof of reserves and talk about that. But it's fascinating to me to get a peek behind the curtain, if you will, as to what's going on down there. Because, I mean, it is figuratively and literally so foreign to the way that we're privileged to be able to operate in the States and in Canada as well. And I mean, really almost everywhere in the world. It will be interesting to see how things shape up with Bitcoin down there, because it's the ideal use case. It's the situation that I think if we could do it in a more controlled way, everyone would like to see in other parts of the world, you know, with the collapse of a fiat currency to have it then replaced by Bitcoin, hopefully not in a situation where the government is extorting you and supporting drug dealers and being corrupt. But there's definitely elements that lend right to the perfect use case for Bitcoin. I want to move over to proof of reserves, though, because this is something that you sent me an article a week or so ago, and I gave it a read, and I thought it was incredibly insightful and timely. Could you give just a brief overview of proof of reserves?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So proof of reserves is something that our company led in. We've been built on this DNA of, if we're going to build financial services for Bitcoin, they should be built in the same way that Bitcoin was built. And by that, I mean, it should be fully transparent, and it should give users the ability to trust but verify where their funds are being held at all time. One of the biggest frustrations that we have as participants in the industry is how slow the industry itself and platforms and participants in the space have been to extend this transparency that is innate or inherent to the protocol from inception to the services they provide to their users. So today, there are very few companies in the world, probably fitting in one hand, that, like Ledin, show users on the Bitcoin chain where their funds are held at all times in real time. There's no audit required. There's no extra steps. I don't have to go hash an instruction to see that my coins were included in your audit. It is there in real time, where the address that you sent the Bitcoin to as a user is the address where they've remained, and you can verify that. So we call that on-chain proof of reserves. client facing, because the client has to have the ability to go on a node or a block explorer and not basically trust what we say to them, but check and verify that what we told them is in fact the case because the Bitcoin network says so. That is something that is built into our products today. Well, we're going to finalize the immediate or automatic proof of reserve piece on our B2X product, which is our latest product. And we're just working through some of the tech details to enable that. But that's finalized and we're going to be rolling that out hopefully by the end of next week. And the piece essentially was a call to the industry to reflect on the fact that there's just not enough people being transparent. And there's two things happening right now. One, people are, instead of becoming more and more transparent, people are essentially continuing to build custody practices that were very similar to the financial services before, where you don't know where your bank has the dollars that you've deposited. You don't know who they're lending it to. You don't know how much of it they're lending it to. You don't even know if they have them because you have no way to verify. Bitcoin has all these abilities, yet no service has these features, or very few. Essentially, the purpose of the piece is saying, why are we the only ones doing this? It was really just a call to the space in general to say, we have the tools, the technology, it's innate to the protocol. Like, it's there for us to use. Why are we rebuilding the system we had to escape?
What's it? Stockholm syndrome? Everyone goes back to the prison that they're familiar with. I think that we've been captive by it for so long that it's just the situation that we're comfortable with, even though it's totally shit. The underhanded or undermining or shady practices, I think generally are just termed fuckery. Yep. And it's rampant in crypto. You know, when I read that article, I mean, it got me fired up because how I view everything in crypto is it's as if somebody hit the reset button on the economy. Now, we have the ability to build very similar businesses to all of the existing traditional businesses, but build them better, build them either, you know, with or on a blockchain in service of the mining community or mass adoption of cryptocurrency. And we don't have to adopt all of the fuckery that has been perpetuated for the last 300, 400, 500 years. But what's happening is you have people who are capitalists at their core, which, you know, me too, but somewhere along the lines, they've just gotten jaded and they continue to operate in this space as a bank would operate in another space. The, you know, the classic example is Wells Fargo, right? Wells Fargo is a bank that popped up during the gold rush of the 1840s. Still to this day, Wells Fargo is in existence. And there are a lot of people rushing to be the Wells Fargo of crypto right now. There are lots of, I mean, DeFi is big, but there are lots of other companies that are aiming to basically just replace the bank. It's very odd to me how quickly people are reverting to it. And on the other side of it, how we're not really self-policing as a community. There's not a lot of people that are saying, you know, I'm not going to use that because it's exactly what I hate.
100%. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think this boils down to the fact that, unfortunately, whether we like to admit it or not, fuckery is profitable.
For sure.
That's why these services are continuing along with the fuckery, is because they have this huge pressure. It's like, why am I going to be transparent where being transparent is going to cost me money and I can make more money if I'm not, right? So not being transparent allows you to do a few things. One, it allows things like QuadriGax to happen, right? Like, users can't verify if Gerald Cotton has $250 million of full deposit. They can't, they don't know how much other people have on the platform. They don't even know how much they have on the platform. But if I at least knew that I sent, you know, 3 Bitcoins to the platform and I'm one looking at my wallet, I'm only seeing 0.2, then I know something's up.
Right.
But because all I'm seeing is accounting entries from a software program, I never have the ability to see if anything's going wrong. Right. And so this lack of transparency enables really bad actors like QuadriGax to happen. And then the other piece that is, everybody comes down really hard on this idea of regulations, right? And why regulations exist, how restrictive they are, and how they don't allow people to participate in X or Y. But the reality is that these regulations came, or were set in place because there were bad actors that were just swindling and taking advantage of people. So what happens today is, for example, like, there are standards and rules and laws and licenses for doing certain types of activities in most mature economies and economies that hold, you know, property rights and the right of law. But what's happening is a lot of these mature economies like the United States, like Canada, like, you know, even many others, they don't have the bandwidth or frankly the pressure to create guidelines for this space, right? So what's really happening is that you're having guys that are competing on transparency and honesty go up against people that are not being transparent and honest and have no requirement to be transparent and honest. And so what's happening is, I think, is clients, they're not discerning. They don't understand the risks entirely. They're not being told the risks entirely. And they're opting for these, you know, platforms that have these sexier offerings, right? Because they can get away with being less transparent. They can charge less money. They can promise better things. And right. You're seeing the honest companies struggle because they have to compete on education, which we know, most of us know that it's just a very long road to walk, right? It's just to say, this is the right thing and people will find the truth one day. Well, you know what? You have to keep the lights on and people need to find out who you are today. You don't have the luxury of waiting 10 years for things to fall through. And mm-hmm. So this is putting a lot of pressure on companies basically to go the other way. And it's because, you know, you're sitting here in the United States or in Canada and you're following all these rules and you're treating your customers fairly, but you're losing customers to somebody in Malta who is not at all telling the truth, who is, you know, saying they're doing one thing or doing the other. Mm-hmm. And how, you know, the only way that stops is when the people in Malta lost their money and they come running to you. But that process of educating them in the interim is difficult. So I think the incentives are misaligned. And essentially, because the number of users doing their homework is not high enough, it's not rewarding the companies that are doing things right.
I can't speak to decentralized finance specifically because, you know, I don't know the practices of the others. I will say that, you know, we talked about this before the podcast, mining pools are a big area where I think that there is a bait and switch model or a lack of transparency where people aren't, you know, a lot of people just aren't sure what their fees are. And it's a variable, right? It's a dev fee. Mm-hmm. So it's a sliding variable fee. So you're unsure on a monthly basis. When I was in Prague, I was speaking to the Slush Pool and the Brains guys, who I think are one of the best groups of people in this space. They are attempting to do so much for Bitcoin's network for free. And yes, they operate a for-profit mining pool. But we were talking about this because, you know, there are other pools out there that are basically just creating this race to the bottom in fees. So they attract more users, which is very hard to compete with if you're a for-profit business that has, you know, overhead and expenses. But then they're, let's say, sliding in extra fees in places that people aren't looking. So we were talking about this. How do you educate around it? Is there a way that you can start to build a proper educational platform? Can you speak to the human nature of people to get them to do things that are not cost driven, you know, where they'll use something where they may not make as much money?
That's a good question. I mean, again, I don't think it's a problem that is isolated to pools or exchanges. Like it happens in mm-hmm. the lending space all the time. Like people are told, hey, come place your Bitcoin as collateral and get a loan. And oh, by the way, your Bitcoin will be safely held with us. And they turn right around and they're lending out that Bitcoin at 2% without collateral. And so that's like full fractional. But there are no disclosures to the user that this is happening. It's all built into the terms of service. And then there are lending companies that'll say loans starting at 4%. And then you get to the site and it's 15. And there's no requirements from them to actually explicitly say that why they're paying that. So, you know, this is a challenge that, you know, you only solve through education and experience, right? Like I can guarantee you that the people who lost $100,000 in QuadraGax are going to want proof of reserves on their next exchange, right? Yep. I can guarantee you the people at Mt. Gox are very much know your keys, know your Bitcoin people. Mm-hmm. But these things take time. And if QuadraGax hadn't happened, I bet you 90% of users would still be there without batting an eye. And same with Mt. Gox, like, right? So a lot of times you can't really tell what's in the back until the house of cards just falls completely. And I think this is a process that takes time, but, you know, hopefully the regulators will also catch on and help the companies that are doing things right by providing just even basic guidelines. Because I'll tell you one thing that has been a challenge. Like when a regulator does nothing and just lets everybody do whatever they want, that can be perceived as very permissive and open and good, right? But at the same time, if you are a company that is trying to show users how you're doing things differently and how you comply and respect the rule of law, and there is nowhere for you to be registered, or there is no guidance for things for you to follow, and there is no requirements for your competitors to even improve on it a little bit, that enables things like QuadraGax.
Yeah.
And that enables things like Einstein. right? And unfortunately, Canada has now made the limelight, not because of their permissive legislation, but because of their bad activity that's happening, right?
Right.
And so, and again, it's also challenging for us as a financial services company to go out and meet with our investors and say, okay, what is your regulatory framework? And say, Canada has no regulatory framework for crypto businesses. That's difficult because investors like black and white, they don't like gray. And so you need to be able to say, this is the framework, here's how we comply, here's when we enrolled, here's who we report to, right? You know, the guidance notice that came out yesterday is encouraging because it seems like Canadian regulators are heading in that direction, albeit with a bit of a strong stance. But I think that these are the kinds of things that we need to continue to see, because when there is no requirement for people to do things, most times than not, they don't do it, particularly if they're on profit.
Right. Well, and this is a very delicate situation, you know, because just as an example, I think consumer protection laws are very important. I don't believe in accredited investor laws. And the two are very closely tied together. Those two laws, whether people believe it or not, are very, very similar. It's basically, for lack of a more eloquent way to put it, it's protecting quote unquote dumb money. Now, I take issue with how dumb money is defined, but I don't take issue with the thought that people who don't understand how finances work should be protected. I think that that's absolutely necessary. Proof of reserves, to me, it sounds like an extension of Trace Mayer's proof of keys, just the ability to have oversight of your Bitcoin at any time or whatever currency you're owning or trading in or whatever the case may be. So I could see it being adopted. What's the plan of attack there? Like, how do you get an exchange to pick this up? What's the plan to roll out?
So in a way, we want to lead the way by saying we are doing this, even though no one's requiring us to do this. We're doing this because we feel it's the right thing to do for our users and for the community. And because we do feel like this is the right thing. This is, in our humble opinion, the way that you want to build, or the way we would like to see services on Bitcoin built, transparent like Bitcoin. Like, I would not want to see a black box built on top of a glass box.
Right.
So we basically took a stance because what we have found, and even though this has been a long road as far as educating people, what we do find is that the users who do their homework and who are worried about risk and who have been through these experiences do choose Ledger. In fact, we're rolling out a new campaign because we were basically just going through our planning for Q1 2020 marketing. And we're going through the list and we realized that 10 of them, but we have 7 that we have essentially reached out to now and got all the information for. But 7 of the top companies in the Bitcoin space globally use Ledin for financing. And so we are getting really great clients. And the clients that come to us stay with us and grow with us. So we are doing things right. And the feedback that we get from our users is that they love what we're doing and they want us to keep it up. So I do think that it is important for companies to do this. It is difficult because, again, you're competing on transparency and you're competing on honesty and integrity, which is not typically speaking what you compete on when you want to market a service. But it is the only way to market a service long-term and a company that wants to stick around for the next decade and not the next minute. And I think that's kind of what we think we're building, and where we so far today, where we have built is this company that the only way we want this company to win and succeed is by growing in that fashion. Like, we would not want to see this company grow and succeed if we have to lie to our people to get there.
Absolutely. Well, Mauricio, I think that that's a great place to wrap things up, man. I'm excited for everything that you guys are working on. And it's nice to know that there are others in the space that operate with integrity and want to see that continue to grow and to perpetuate in a positive way. So I want to thank you for coming on the show. I learned a lot, and hopefully the listeners did as well.
No, thanks a lot. It was really great to come over, and anytime, love to chat mining and Bitcoin and even politics or proof of reserve. So anytime you guys want an update on Venezuela or proof of reserves or what we're doing, feel free to hit us up.
Will do, man. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Take care.
Thanks for tuning into the Hashrate Podcast. We appreciate your continued support. Please do us a favor and leave us a rating and review on your preferred listening platform. And head over to Twitter and give us a follow at Hashrate. That's at H4SHR8.